Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name's Ian Drake, and this is the New Books in Law podcast on the New Books Network. We're joined today by Ken Ilgunas. He is an author, journalist, and sometimes park ranger in Alaska, I believe. Have you been anywhere other than Alaska as a park ranger?
Just Alaska, just a couple parks there.
Okay. So he has hitchhiked 10,000 miles across North America and paddled 1,000 miles across Ontario in a birch bark canoe. And he's walked over 1,700 miles across the Great Plains. And so this is someone who was well-traveled in ways that many of us are not. But he's joining us today to talk about his latest book entitled This Land Is Our Land, How We Lost the Right to Roam and How to Take It Back. And so, Ken, thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Law podcast.
It's a pleasure to be on.
So, why did you write this book? What brought you to the topic?
I became a roaming rights advocate. I became the roaming rights advocate. And I say the, not as in like principal roaming right advocate, but as in possibly the only one in America. I kind of just happened upon the subject. And, you know, I could give a long-winded answer, but the short answer is that I went on this very unusual journey. I hiked across the Great Plains from Alberta, Canada, down to the Gulf Coast of Texas. And I was doing that to kind of chronicle the Keystone XL pipeline and how that might affect landowners. And when you're following a pipeline, you can't follow roads because pipelines don't follow roads. Pipelines like to get to their refinery in as few miles as possible. So they go across croplands, grasslands, private property. So this meant that if I wanted to follow this pipeline, I'd be walking over Alberta prairie, Saskatchewan pasture, Montana hills, South Dakota canyons, Nebraska cornfields. In order to follow this Keystone XL pipeline, I'd essentially have to trespass across America. And this just kind of just gave me a one-of-a-kind journey. Because, you know, when most people go on walks, they go on their national park, they go on a proper scenic trail like the Appalachian Trail. No one goes on a private property journey. And I was the first of its kind, at least in modern times. And the conversations I was having were just very interesting with folks. And it made me think about private property in a completely new way. For instance, I remember this one woman in Montana. She was a rancher. And she asked me which roads I'm taking. And I said, I'm not taking roads. I'm taking the fields. And I'm trying to get to so-and-so town. And she said, oh, you must be taking Road X. And I said, no, I'm actually walking in the grass. My feet are in the grass. And she says, oh, you must be taking, you know, Road Y. And I said, no, I'm like literally walking across country. And she just had this blank look on her face. It just couldn't register the idea that someone was walking across private property. It was just so inconceivable. And I was warned again and again and again that I was going to get shot for doing this. And I never thought I was doing anything nefarious. You know, I was just placing my feet on grass. I was taking pictures of sunsets. I was camping in woods whenever I could find them. This was a just beautiful country and such a peaceful trip. And I just thought there was something wonderful about having a whole landscape to myself. But there was also something deeply sad about this. You know, why can't other people see this land? Now I told you I wasn't going to give you a long-winded answer, and I think I just did that. But this it really got me interested in private property, and then I began to think, you know, how do other countries conceive of private property? What are their laws? And when I began to write my book about my journey trespassing across America, I looked at the countries like Scotland and England and Sweden. In Sweden, they have this thing called allemansrätten, which means every man's right, and that's every man's or every person's right to essentially go wherever they want responsibly for hiking, camping, paddling a canoe. And I thought, you know what? Why can't we have allemansrätten in America? Why can't we have the right to roam in America? And that set me off on my journey to write my latest book, This Land is Our Land, where I become the Roman rights advocate.
Okay. And so I should note for our listeners, this is really the second book that you've published on this topic. The first, as you mentioned a moment ago, is Trespassing Across America, which is chronicling the journey that you just referenced. But this one is, it references that journey, that specific trek you took, but it's really more of, I would say this is kind of an advocacy piece, right?
That's right. Yeah. Trespassing Across America. That's more of like a fun Bill Bryson travel narrative. Whereas, and the right to roam is a part of that. I talk about private property a little bit, but it's more or less a footnote. And I thought, you know what, I could maybe take that footnote and turn it into this treatise. So it was my idea. I kind of felt like I had the subject all to myself. I think I do too. I shouldn't say that because there's a couple of law scholars like Eric Freifogel and John Lovett and Brian Sowers and Jerry Anderson. And these are people who I consulted with on the making of my book. And they're writing about these subjects. But I think I'm probably the first to come out and really advocate for it in a very overt sort of way. When you're one person out of 324 million and you feel like you kind of have an idea to yourself, it's lonely, but it's also invigorating. And that sort of invigoration kind of put some fire in my belly and gave me the spirit to write this book.
Well, I agree that it comes through your enthusiasm for this, definitely comes through in the text. And I find it intriguing. I will forthrightly tell you, I'm not sure that I'm sold on your argument, but we can address that in a little while. I wanted to address the fact that you noted that you felt like you weren't doing anything nefarious. And I think that certainly it wasn't nefarious, but of course, the question is, it's potentially illegal in the U.S. And so this is, you're concerned primarily with a law that dates back to the Middle Ages in the Anglo-American jurisprudential realm, which is trespass law. And trespass has been with us for a long time. But also you look to the history of English land use. And so in making your case for, and ultimately, I think we should tell the listener forthrightly or upfront, what is it that you want to change? And then we'll talk about some of the history that you review in making your argument. But what is it that you want about the current legal regime that you want to change here in the U.S.?
Yeah. So basically, well, let's explain just briefly what the right to roam is. It exists in countries like Sweden, Finland, Norway, Scotland. These are systems that have very strong, generous right to roam systems. There's also countries that have kind of a more partial system, and they consist of England and Wales, Denmark, Germany, Poland. Kind of partial or full right to roam systems are spread all across Europe. Now, a full right to roam system as it exists in Scotland, where I'm actually talking to you from right now, it allows people to access not just public land where there's national parks and stuff, but private land, places that are owned by individuals. It allows ordinary citizens to access these areas for reasons of education, reasons of personal transportation, you know, walking across the field to get to the bus stop, or recreation, whether that's hiking, camping, birding, mountain biking, horseback riding. And this is called the right to roam here. And we can get into kind of the rules and regulations. It's not a complete free for all. It's very regulated. It's very clear in the law. But what I'm advocating for is the right to, I'm advocating for importing the right to roam from these places, to conceive of it in America, either on a national level, on a state level, or a local level.
Okay. And so you take a look at these other jurisdictions, these other nations, and in Scandinavia, for example, it's a tradition that has eventually become essentially legally recognized. But in, for example, England, it's essentially something that's been imposed only relatively recently. So can you discuss the effort and the resistance to that effort that you recount regarding the English context?
That's right. Yeah. And you're right. It's different than in Sweden, where something like Allemansrätten, the right to roam, has essentially always existed. But in England, it's changed a lot. The definition of property has been very dynamic. It's changed a lot. Going back to the Middle Ages, you have places considered commons lands. These are lands generally owned by the community and can be used for a number of different purposes, whether it's gathering wood, whether it's their own sort of recreation, whether it's letting cattle feed. And these were owned by, who exactly owned these was kind of unclear. It was sort of a lord who got his landowning rights from a monarch, but the relationship between the lord and those people beneath him was complicated. You know, there was a general understanding that the serfs made food and did a whole bunch of other services, and the lord protected them. We go through a period of enclosure, essentially starting in the 1400s, 1500s. It really picks up in Georgian England in like the 1700s and 1800s. And that's when acts of parliament were enclosing the land. And we call it enclosing because walls were put up, ditches were put into place. And this was to kind of modernize agriculture. It was to boost productivity. And as a result, the commons got closed down. People no longer had access to land that they considered their communities. And it kind of approaches something like our modern day system of private property, where one landowner can exclude whomever he or she wishes. So then you have this movement that begins in the early 1900s, and these are when local people begin to fight for access rights, for walking rights. They want access back to these places. So in the early 1900s, you see all these walking groups form. And in the 1930s, there's one especially dynamic group up in northern England. They go on this mass trespass. There was this big mountain there. Well, not big mountain. It was like 3,000 feet. It's called Kinder Scout. And all of these people, about 400 young folks, they set out to this mass trespass because they wanted to take back this mountain, which was owned by just a few aristocrats. So they go and they do this mass trespass. And the six ringleaders of this trespass go to jail. And this just is, and they go, they're put in jail for 6 months just for trespassing. So this upsets all of these walking groups, and they begin to kind of coalesce. And there's this huge 10,000 person gathering, and they're protesting this. And what's born is the modern walking rights movement in Britain. And eventually the group would form, it's called the Ramblers, and they would fight for access legally. And this kind of continued all the way up until about 2000, the year 2000, when the Labour government took over and they took on these walking rights issues, and they passed something called the Countryside and Rights of Way Act. And this provides people access to mountains, moors, heaths, and downs. And some of those are just kind of fancy English words for unimproved grasslands. And later in 2009, I believe, they passed an act that opened up all of the English and Welsh coastlines. So here you see a movement that began with enclosure and then led to mass trespasses and then finally law. Now, this only opened up about 10% of England and Wales. It's nothing like what exists in Scotland and Sweden, where you have, about 85 to 90% of the land that's accessible for public recreation.
Okay, and so this is a recent political effort. In Scotland, too, was recent. It was in 2003 that there was a law passed in Scotland that allowed this substantial access to private land, right?
That's right. Yeah. So in Scotland, the situation was that they didn't really have any, even though Scotland is sort of its own country within the broader UK system, they didn't have any legal capabilities to define their own property laws, their own land laws. Not until devolution. That's when England and Scotland created their own separate regional governments. So the Scottish government was reestablished, I believe, in 1999. And one of the first things they did was pass this Land Reform Act. This was in 2003. They passed this Land Reform Act of 2003, and it did a number of things. But one of the things it did was it formally created into law the right to roam, which is remarkable of all the right to roam systems, because I believe it's the only one enshrined into law. The Swedish one talks about it in the Swedish constitution, but I don't think it's formally recognized into law. So the Scottish law, it provides people with recreational freedoms over private land so long as you take access responsibly. And that means that you can mountain bike over private land, you can horseback ride, you can hike, you can camp, and you can do all these things as long as you do so responsibly. Now, there's also an access code that they published, and it lays out all the things you can and cannot do. Like, you cannot camp or trespass around someone's home or their yard. You can't have your dog unleashed around livestock. You can't walk over vulnerable crops. This only applies to non-motorized getting around. As a landowner, you also have some responsibilities. Interestingly, like, you're not allowed to put up a no trespassing sign when you're trying to deter walkers through what is now open land. You're not even allowed to grow hedges for the purpose of excluding walkers, which I just love.
Okay, so do we know if there's been, this has been recently implemented, or at least implemented within the last decade or so, do we know if there's been much litigation about the parameters of this use in terms of what is reasonable, what's unreasonable?
Well, I mean, there's been a few court cases, and John Lovett, he's an American scholar who's chronicled them all really well. And there's just very, like, common sense solutions. For instance, there was this this one family who had some land, and there was horseback riders going through the land, and when it got muddy, they were just destroying the trail. So they went to court, and they figured out, you know what, this is good for walkers, but this area of land, you can't have horseback riders. So just little fixes like that. And there's this park called Loch Lomond. I always mispronounce it. And the Trossachs, and they were having some problems with litter along a lakeside. So they banned all camping from there. And when I talk to Scots about that, they always say, oh, you know, like this is the beginning of the end. But when I see that, I see it's actually working. You know, this is it's working. It's treating property owners and government entities like their park service very respectfully. They're dealing with the problems and not just letting this be a complete messy free for all.
So in discussing the U.S. context, it seems to me that not only is there an obstacle for those who want a right to roam in the U.S. In regard to law, you would have to do it essentially at both the state and even potentially the federal level, because, of course, private land goes across state boundaries. And so there may be this federalism issue, but even beyond the law, it seems to me that your biggest obstacle is probably changing people's attitudes, because you recounted the story of the woman who simply doesn't grasp at first blush that you're discussing traversing land, but rather she just assumes you must mean you're going down particular roads that you can't recall the names of. But instead, you're trying to communicate to her, no, I'm walking the pipeline here. And so that seems to me to be an example of how well entrenched, no pun intended, the view regarding the sacredness of private property rights are in the U.S. And that seems to be the biggest obstacle. Is that right?
I don't disagree with you at all. And I would say a couple things to that. First of all, this idea may not take root in America anytime soon. And I'm happy thinking of this idea and this book as an idea that could take off in 10 years, in 50 years, in 100 years. You know, I'm just a little bird who caught a seed in his mouth in Scotland and is coming to distribute it across the pond to America. And it's kind of up to the ecosystem to determine if it wants such a seed. So I'll say that, but I also want to say that culture is dynamic, society is dynamic. How we think of private property is dynamic. You know, I spend a whole chapter talking about private property from our hunter-gatherer days up until today. And what I learned from all that research is boy, you know, it really changes. It changes per country. It changes per era. So do I believe that the U.S. is capable of changing in a way that would welcome a right to roam? And I say, absolutely. And I say, more so that I'd say the right to roam is in our bones. It's in our spirit. It's in the American psyche. And more substantially, perhaps, it's in our history. You know, we essentially had, at least Euro-Americans essentially had, the right to roam from the colonial days up until around the Civil War. This meant that folks in the colonies, whether it's New or the early states, New York, Massachusetts, Georgia, they had the right to roam, whether for fishing purposes, hunting purposes, or getting around purposes, and maybe even just fun purposes. Through the early stages of America, we did not conceive of this very rigid and harsh and inflexible way that we see property now. Back then, you had the right to walk over land that was unenclosed, which means no fences, and there wasn't that many fences. Back in the 1850s, only 1% of Texas was enclosed. I believe almost 90% of the South was open range during that time, and you couldn't walk over land that was improved. You were allowed to walk over unimproved land, which means that you're allowed to walk over land where there's no crops and stuff like that. So we had kind of a more common understanding of land. Land was considered just something slightly more open, slightly more shared. So I think that shows just in our short nation's very short history that if we can go from this more open understanding of private property to this more rigid understanding of private property, there's nothing that says we can't go back to that more open understanding, perhaps just with a more 21st century point of view. This will be less about hunting and fishing, which were necessary things to do back in the colonial days, but this could be more to fulfill our nature and recreation needs.
So you look to this past as a way of less of a story of a golden age, but rather than as instruction for us to be optimistic about changing attitudes. But I think that still begs the question of what is your suspicion about why the attitudes change? You call it a rigidity regarding private property. And of course, the enthusiasts of private property might say, well, wait a minute, it's less about rigidity than it is about efficient and effective use of land, and the ability to exclude is something that we need in the U.S. if we're going to be a modern industrialized nation. And so it's less about a mentality of rigidity rather than efficient use and the ability to exclude as part of that. What would you say to that?
Yeah, well, I'd say a couple things to that. And one of the arguments I anticipated, and I'm going to get to what you just said, but I want to add something first. One of the arguments I anticipated when I wrote this book was that we're a private property country. We've always been a private property country, and we always will be a private property country. People would say, you know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, they'd be rolling in their graves if they, heard about the right to roam. I kind of wanted to end that argument. Because I think we're always like, oh, you know, we have this like originalist point of view, like the country always has to live up to the nation's founders. So I was so fascinated when I looked at these early laws in early America and looked at how the founders spent their boyhoods. Thomas Jefferson fishing in rivers, Benjamin Franklin perhaps conducting his famous kite experiment on private property, John Adams. You know, the list goes on. So I kind of wanted to end that. I wanted to show that actually we are not this rigid private property country down to our marrow. It's been more complex than that. It's been more dynamic than that. Now, as for your question, and if private property exists for a very sensible and logical economic or social reason, you know, I'm certainly open to the argument that that's the case for certain areas, maybe areas that, you know, where there's a big suburban neighborhood. You know, it's not good to have people wandering into people's backyards and looking into people's windows. Obviously, I think that should not be allowed. Or maybe there's areas where there's intense industrial agriculture and there's reason to keep people off that for reasons of efficiency, and a more rigid understanding of private property may apply there. I wouldn't enthusiastically argue against that. I would only point to European countries that are doing it well. And when I study countries like Scotland or Norway or Sweden, and I see how private property and industry and recreation are all pretty much happily coexisting. I mean, if it works over there in these capitalistic Western democracies, why can't it work over in this capitalistic Western democracy? They get away with it. Why can't we here?
And so in an effort to create an openness to this and a receptivity to it, you in this book, you've outlined some of the potential counterarguments, the one that I just mentioned about modern industrialism and the efficiency and the need to be able to exclude. But one response that you anticipate is the claim that, well, listen, we've got these public parks and the public parks are huge, lots of land out there. Why doesn't that satisfy the urge to roam rather than having somebody come across my back 40?
Yeah. Yeah. And this is something I kind of mathematically break down in the book. When you look at the distribution of our public lands, and America does have plenty of public lands, I'd say about 30-35% of America is publicly owned. That means it's either owned by the state or federal government, which is, you know, that's one third of America. That sounds like plenty of land to roam. But 40% of that land is in Alaska, which is pretty much unreachable to most Americans. And then the rest of it is mostly concentrated in really low population Western states. It's Western states like Nevada and Wyoming and Montana, where there's really not that many people. So, you know, I grew up in suburban Buffalo, New York. I lived in rural North Carolina. You know, I didn't have access to any of these public spaces. If I wanted to go to a national park, like I did when I was in my early 20s, I drove several days to get to Yellowstone. Granted, there was probably one closer to that. But my point is that these public places, as grand and amazing and as wonderful as they are, they're just really not accessible to most people. And when I think of the right to roam, I don't think of this once a year, week-long trip where we finally get to stretch our legs. I think of a right to roam creating a system, an atmosphere where ordinary Americans can step out their front door and walk across a field and take their dogs, or maybe just get outside of the suburb or town, you know, just a train ride or a bus ride away and enjoy a hike from there. It would just, I just think it would enable so much more activity out in the outdoors. And as I argue in my book, there's a whole bunch of social benefits that come from having Americans in the outdoors more, whether it's physical and mental health, whether it's building social capital and social trust, or just giving everyone just a little steroid shot of freedom every now and then.
And so in an effort to persuade people that this is a legal change that should occur in order for the betterment of people who want to roam, it would seem to me that, especially in the American context, because you noted the population, well over 300 million people, you've had about a sixth of that in England, so over a little over 50 million population in England. And so you had this sustained almost, 70-year-long, maybe a little longer, active political movement on the part of admittedly a minority, but nevertheless, it eventually persuaded a majority in Parliament. Certainly, interest group politics are a norm for both Britain and the U.S., but the group that has to persuade either Congress or perhaps on the state level, different states, and maybe that's where the change would occur first, is at the state level. It would seem to me that that's going to have to be pretty organized. And in other words, you're going to have to change minds, yes, but you're really also going to have to get organized in order to help change those minds. So how do you see that potentially coming to fruition in the U.S.? Because there are no, as far as I know, and I don't recall you actually documenting any Rambler-type groups in the U.S., right?
There's not. And in fact, when I got in touch with America's leading walking organization, America Walks, they were generally supportive of my idea and they were like, yeah, go for it. But when I tried to explain to them what it was, they just really had no idea what I was talking about. They just, like that lady in Montana, they couldn't really conceive of walking over private land. It was more like, more about making communities more walkable and creating more trails and like that. So you're right in that there is not an interest group. There are a couple folks in the fight. I'd say maybe the most prominent would be the Surf Rider Foundation, and they're kind of a beach organization which advocate for cleaning up beaches and creating more access and things like that, because you know, you do have wonderful access to beaches in places like Oregon and Hawaii, but you do have limited access to beaches in places like Massachusetts and Maine and now Florida with a new law that was passed there. So yes, there aren't that many. And where would such a group come from? This may be outside of my expertise, but I could say a few things to that. One, the right to roam might be something that interests folks who think of themselves as socialist Democrats. So the movement that kind of was behind Occupy Wall Street or the Bernie Sanders election campaign, who are fighting for more equality, a more shared understanding of a more common good approach, kind of pushing back against the last 30 or 40 years of neoliberal economics, you might find some supporters in that group. But I should also say, in Sweden, and this really interested me, this was actually championed by conservatives. This was Allemansrätten was championed by conservatives. It was kind of a national pride sort of thing. Like, we're really proud of the land and we want to make it accessible to everyone. So when I'm thinking about, you know, the future of the right to roam, I don't really want this to be a left issue or a right issue, because this is something that would benefit everybody. And the last thing I want to do is polarize it. And interesting, I had some a conversation with some folks in Wyoming recently, and they were wildlife biologists and just kind of passionate about the land and the animals. And they said Wyoming might be the first right to roam state. And they said they're probably going to send my book to some Wyoming legislatures. And that just kind of really confused me, because I think of Wyoming as this really conservative state, and why would they welcome what could be perceived as this really liberal issue? And it's just that you have these giant estates out in the West, whether it's Montana or Wyoming or Idaho, and you have an impassioned group of hunters and sportsmen and fishermen who can't access their publicly owned creeks. They can't access their publicly owned Bureau of Land Management land or National Forest land. And they want the right to be able to get to these places, or at most even access them over on private property.
And was that the viewpoint of the conservatives in Sweden as well? In other words, was it an access concern, or what was it? Was there a philosophical point that was construed as being uniquely conservative that the Swedish argued?
I think it was more of a pride, and I guess you could kind of classify that as more of a philosophical point of view, rather than kind of a more practical issue of access. This was something that celebrated the very act of being Swedish, having access to this land and being able to see it and experience it.
And another, it seems to me, another transpartisan point that you make is that this is not merely a bunch of granola hippies who are wanting access to private land, but rather this is good for everybody. In other words, there's some certain mental health benefits that you stress as being derived from being out in nature. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, well, there's just like countless studies. There's a wonderful book called The Nature Fix by Florence Williams, and her whole book is basically hammering home this argument that access to nature improves our lives physically, mentally. It helps bind communities. It helps enhance social trust. And her book can speak to that much better than mine can. But I do spend a little bit of time, and there's studies that show that, like, for instance, there's a Stanford study where they had someone walk on this nice green campus, and then there was then on the city streets of Palo Alto, and they surveyed, they studied the participants, and they had just much lower rates of depression, anxiety. They just generally felt a lot better. And this is just common sense. Anyone would kind of know that. But you're right. I'm not just talking about this from like the bearded granola eating backpacker perspective. And in fact, I should say that I'm not anti private property at all. You know what? The right to roam doesn't abolish private property. Landowners still get to own their land. Landowners still get to pass their land down to their children. Landowners can still build what they want, whatever they want on it. They can grow what crops they want on it. All that the right to roam does, all that I'm advocating for, is a more shared understanding of private property.
And in some ways that what you're doing conceptually is something that's existed a long time in English law. Anybody who goes to law school in the U.S. and they learn English property law as part of their understanding of modern property law in the U.S., they often talk about the rights of ownership as a famous phrase from an English case called a bundle of sticks. And each stick in that bundle is a different type of right that you get when you own something. And one of them is the right to exclude. You have the right to sell. You have the right to inherit it. You can mortgage it. You can use it as capital, et cetera, or as an asset for a loan. And you've got all these rights of use and enjoyment, but you subdivide it because you're concerned with how those rights are actually implemented. So it seems to me that legally, one of the conceptual arguments you're arguing is this does not abolish private property, but rather it merely alters the nature of the right to exclude because, as you've noted, the right to exclude continues to exist. You're not taking that right away, but rather you're limiting it for one's private property.
That's right. And we should clarify what the right to exclude is. And generally, every landowner has the right to exclude, except in cases where there's easements and other legal implements. But it allows the landowner to shut off his or her land to other people, to post no trespassing signs, to put up fences and walls, and to place fines or punishment upon people who trespass over that. Again, this right to exclude does not exist in places like Sweden and Scotland, at least except for around their immediate property, around their home and yard. And the question of the right to exclude, I think the question behind any sort of property law is of moral legitimacy. Is it morally grounded? Is the right to exclude morally grounded? In my test for whether a property law such as the right to exclude is morally grounded is, does it serve the common good? Because our property laws should be designed to serve the common good. And if someone can convince me that the right to exclude does serve the common good, then I'd be much more liable to kind of give up. But I don't think I can be convinced that the right to exclude serves the common good. When you look at land ownership in America, it's startling. The top 100 landowners in the U.S., they own vast amounts of property. The top 100 landowners, they own 40 million acres. That's about essentially about 20 Yellowstone national parks. That's that land area, that's about the states of Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., Maryland. That's just 100 people owning that size of land out of 324 million people. The last survey of land ownership in America, that was in 1978. That was done by the Department of Agriculture. They determined that the top 1% owned 48% of all private land. The top 5% owned 75% of private land. And sadly, we don't have any more up-to-date statistics on that, but I would argue that that's either stayed the same or gotten worse as wealth inequality has gotten out of control. So I think what you're seeing here is what, as you're seeing with wealth inequality, is land increasingly falling into the hands of fewer and fewer of super rich landowners. And when I think of the next 100 years, when we're increasingly urbanizing, we're increasingly suburbanizing and concentrating in these metropolitan centers, and all the land in between is increasingly obtained by few and fewer people, there's the possibility that we might experience a crisis in recreation. And I think something like the right to roam is a sensible solution. The radical thing to say would be, let's redistribute the land or let's take away the land. That would be the radical thing. I'm definitely not arguing that. But just simply opening up land for responsible recreation, I think that actually makes this sometimes brutal, ruthless, global capitalist world we live in, it allows us to exist within that framework just a little bit more harmoniously. You know, when I think of all that plagues us, you know, people feeling a sense of inequality, people feeling a sense of unempowerment. When you just drive down the road and you just look at all that land and, you know, you just know it's someone else's, that you can't even step foot on it. I just think that that breaks its way into the national psyche a little bit. And I think, like, if we were able to look at that field, look at that mountain and say, you know what, that's someone's land. Yes, that's someone's land, but it's also sort of my land. I think that would go a great, that would help us think of ourselves as more of a unified country that's in it together, that's a little bit more equal, that's got a shared fate and a shared sense of land ownership. And I don't know, like, I think in the next 100, 200 years, an understanding like that just might make the country a little bit better.
So where do you go from here? As we began this conversation, you noted you're essentially a lone voice on this in the U.S. context. And so you are probably going to go out to Wyoming and talk to some people out there and make your pitch there. But how do you see your role in this continuing?
Oh boy, I don't know. Just like, you know, I wrote, my first book was a book on student debt. My second book was a book on pipelines and climate change. And this one's on a right to roam. So I do have the habit of investing myself very intensely in a subject for a few years and then moving on to something different. And, you know, I just have a lot of interest and I can't see myself being some right to roam leader for the next 20 years of my life. I just got other things I want to do. I see myself as just that seed planter. You know what? I'm just going to plant this seed in the ground, and it's up to everyone else if they want it to take off. But I want to give the idea the best shot it has. So you know, like this fall, I'm going on a bit of a speaking tour to Northeastern colleges. So I'll present my ideas to some young folks there and see if it applies. And I've written op-eds for High Country News and the New York Times. So I'm doing my darndest, but it's really up to other people. It's up to the idea if it wants to take root.
The book is This Land is Our Land, How We Lost the Right to Roam and How to Take It Back. And the author, Ken Ilgunas, has joined us today on New Books in Law podcast. Ken, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.